The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Science has given us the means with which to annihilate ourselves before it ever told us why we were here. Congratulations, we might say, to people in the scientific world. We have now come to the point where humankind could commit cosmicide, where more than four, perhaps five, separate methods could destroy all of humankind. Science has bequeathed, it was said in the words of one great leader, as its final gift to mankind, the ability to annihilate or to eradicate all of humankind from the face of the earth. But science cops out, because science says we must stay out of the field of the metaphysical. We're not moralists. We cannot say how or why or whether these things that we invent should be used, but we will continue to invent them nevertheless. Some time ago, science lost its way. Science does not know where it is going. It does not know why it exists. It does not know, as a body of, let's say, belief, or as an approach, or as a field of endeavor in the human educative process, what are its goals. Since science cops out continually by saying there is no perfect knowledge and no perfect knower, since science is open at both ends, saying that we can only postulate and never really say that that's a definitive conclusion, since it says incompleteness rules science, and when they try to, you know, initiate you into what is the scientific attitude, what is the spirit of science, they warn you that you can't really ever know. Now, once you get in this field, you've got to say, well, we may safely be led to assume that possibly it may appear that under certain given circumstances, it might be that, but they never do get around to saying, this is so and that is so. Last time I had to break off before I got through with this thing about the spirit of science and the attitude of the uncertainty of man's knowledge, that we can only know incompletely and that incompleteness rules science. Yet, on the other hand, if anybody dares take science to task, as I did in an article not too long ago in the Plain Truth magazine, you can get a ton of hate mail. I was showing, not from my attitude or my idea, but from some scientists' points of view, that this whole thing about the increase of mass and about spaceships and about the speed of light and how, because of the rules that are really ascertainable, measurable, and observable in scientific study, it would be utterly impossible to ever build a spaceship which could travel through space at the speed of light. I showed that that was impossible. Not some attitude or idea of mine, but the proofs of scientific texts on the subject. I got a whole lot of hate mail back. I had been guilty of an incredible blunder. I'd knocked the nose off somebody's god. I'd told Donald Duck to go put his pants on. I called Mickey Mouse a communist or something. People were absolutely upset. For me to imply that science was incapable at some time in the future, even though they admit they couldn't do it now. For me to say that science was limited, that there are certain things which, by the very nature of our universe, impose a no further sign upon scientific endeavor, made some people so angry, I imagine if they had bit themselves, they would have died of hydrophobia. And they wrote me all kinds of hate mail. Well, Pandora's box has been opened. Science has invented the methods by which humankind can commit cosmicide, and then turns around and cops out by saying it is not in the realm of science to tell us how to control those devices, or whether we should. And it's about time we took a good long look at this thing of the spirit of science, the scientific age in which we live, the notion that science can do anything, the notion that science is the salvation of humankind when in practical fact it threatens to be the destruction of humankind, the idea that science has always bailed us out of the last moment in the past, and even though it's the bottom of the ninth inning for all of humankind, science has never failed us in the past, it won't fail us this time. So last time I was taking a look at this thing of the spirit of science. Now here's what worries me about it. This is an excerpt from a pamphlet called Education and the Spirit of Science, which was published by the Educational Policies Commission of the National Education Association of the United States. And this was a pamphlet that suggests guidelines to school teachers all around the country for infusing into the minds of pupils this scientific approach. This was a general approach to the study of science. The worldwide pursuit, it said, and spread of science and technology are commonly recognized. there is less recognition that the values and the modes of thought which underlie science and technology also are becoming pervasive in the world. Science poses a clear challenge to pretensions of absolute certainty. Now, you know, science would tell you, now you can't really be certain that you really exist. You can't be certain that if you throw a ball into the air, it's going to come back down again. You cannot really be certain when you go to bed that gravity is going to keep you in your bed until you go about 8,000 miles and come back and see the sun. And actually you saw it go down the other side of the world. The sun didn't go down. It stayed right where it was. The world just rolled as it does away from it, or at least so it appeared to you as you were looking at it. But science doesn't allow you to say that. Science is, it said, exemplifying its 7 points that it gave, a longing to know and to understand, questioning of all things, search for data and their meaning, demand for verification, respect for logic, consideration of premises, and consideration of consequences. As it broke down these 7 points, it said, the spirit of science is, at bottom, a longing to understand. Now here, on the one hand, the rocks under our feet, the laws that science must use in its interpretation, its investigation of natural phenomena and various consequences, the laws of physics, of energy, the statement of the conservation of energy, the laws of thermodynamics, the idea of inertia, that is that everything just stays there inert and will not move unless it is propelled by force, the ability to do work, all this type of thing, science says, it, at bottom, is a longing to understand. Yet here's a book called the Bible that says, prove all things. It says, test me now herewith. Prove me now herewith. But science says that spiritual knowledge is untestable. That you can't demonstrate whether or not there is a God, science says. And a lot of religionists, cranking their lower lips down to the point where they can about trip on them, go along with that. They seem to be bamboozled by all of the textbooks on science. They take a look at astronomers and their powerful telescopes. They take a look at science and their chemical laboratories, at the atomic and hydrogen bomb, at the space age, man walking on the moon, and we're dazzled by the modern gadgetry of science. We're overwhelmed by the fantastic, accumulative, additive knowledge of thousands of very intelligent minds. And so, many of the religious types say, well, we think that maybe God used evolution. So they try to say they believe in theistic evolution. That is, that there is a God. Now, really, they have to acknowledge that God didn't have to do anything because, I mean, if evolution was going to happen anyhow, then God didn't need to be doing anything to prevent it or to help it along. So they say, well, we'd like to believe in a God. I don't know why they would like to, because really, unless they just got in the profession and that's the way they're making their living, why bother about it? Why not get out of profession and get into some other kind of a living? If you're going to accept evolution, you reject God. And if you're going to accept God, you reject evolution. But you do not need to reject adaptation or infinite variety within a species or mutation or selection. You do not need to reject the idea of many sinkings and raisings of the continental shelf and of the land masses of the earth. You don't need to reject mountain building, the deposition of strata, the burying of fossil life. You know, that's the problem. A lot of people have never really looked into it. Of course, what I'm talking about when I say religion and what most people talk about when they say religion are two different things. So you'd have to stick around for a long time to find out what I mean by that. But to me, religion is, religion in general, man's religions ought to keep God's name out of it. That's what I think about it. But I mean, the religion of the Bible is a far cry from man's religions anyhow. So the Bible and what the Bible says about creation, about God challenging us to prove whether or not he exists, that's a far cry from the idea that Betty Bye stories of immortal souls, you're going to heaven or you're going to an ever-burning hell, which I utterly reject, which is not in the Bible, which you cannot find in the Bible. It just is not in there. But the Bible and what it really says about a resurrection, about the second coming of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, about what it really says about creation and what can be proved in the scientific field, those are not opposites at all. It's a real shame, a real pity, that the fantastic tools of science, the combined collection of the thousands of intelligent minds, the printing presses that print all of these many, many beautiful books, with their gorgeous illustrations, cannot be busily offering people the alternative If they're not going to turn around and really teach people the truth about God, at least on one side of the book say there's a possibility God exists, and on the other side try to disprove it. They admit that scientists have strong attachment to their own schemes and their own concepts, so they are human after all, but a lot of times scientists themselves fail to use what they call the spirit of science.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
I have here a very thick textbook on the biological sciences I was quoting from last time that is introductory material for young, questing, college-age students in our big universities. It's written by a man in Cornell University. It's a very, very finely done work. It says on page 4 of the introduction to this study, now, we must admit that scientists being human, you know, Volkswagens are only human, they said, scientists being human have a strong attachment to the conceptual schemes they have erected, and that the history of science abounds with examples of lack of objectivity on the part of the scientific community psychologically unprepared for radically different new ideas. Now, it talks about the spirit of science. It says no theory in science is ever absolutely and finally proved. Then it says hypotheses, that's guesses, generalizations, that are not testable are inadmissible in science. Now, is it testable that one completely different kind of a creature came from a degenerate, simple ancestor of a completely different kind? There are many sections in this book that are quite interesting. I'm going to skip ahead. I think it was right here a few pages later where they're beginning to introduce students to Darwin and what he did. They say on this page of the introduction that Darwin rejected the notion, this is the first point out of three of them here, he rejected the notion that living creatures are the immutable product of a sudden creation. Well, that's interesting. He didn't do so after he developed his theory. He did so, and then he began to develop the theory. Now, of course, Darwinian theory has been largely slashed and hacked and torn apart and is basically not even all that up to date today. Nevertheless, Darwin's name is still used, and the Darwinian theories and principles are supposedly still the guiding force of evolutionary thought. So it shows that Darwin rejected the notion that living creatures are the immutable products of a sudden creation. Why did he? He saw all these varieties. He saw capacity for almost limitless change, for mutation. He even himself experimented in it. He insisted that change is the rule, that organisms living today have descended by gradual changes from ancient ancestors quite unlike themselves. Now here's where we get into a little bit of the problem. What is a kind and what is a species? I don't believe science knows. Here's the question they ask. Darwin could point to changes produced in domesticated plants and animals. Could look pretty convincing to people. How could anyone doubt that great changes can occur in organisms with time when he has before him the historical evidence of the changes in domesticated form? Where were French poodles and Mexican chihuahuas 2,000 years ago? Well, obviously they didn't exist, did they? Where were you 2,000 years ago? You didn't exist either, did you? Look at all the infinite variety in the human family, not just the dog family, or the cat family, or the cow family, or some other, but look at the infinite variety within human families. So far, so good. Fine. French poodles and Mexican chihuahuas are the result of man's intelligent, selective breeding. So what are they? Birds? No, they're dogs. Are they interfertile? If you let your poodle out in the back alley some night, and it's a she, and she's in you-know-what, and then you say, oh no, a few weeks later, and then you go down to the vet, and the vet says, I'm sorry, guess what? And you say, oh no, and maybe you got a thoroughbred, excuse me, a purebred, thoroughbred for horses. What comes out? You don't have the faintest idea. You don't have the faintest idea. They could look like, you know, they could be half pug nose. They could be almost anything. You really don't know. Now, I ask you, is the poodle not a dog? Because man's intelligent, selective breeding, finally, gradually, taking certain characteristics apparent. I mean, look at humans. Hitler had the idea of creating a super race because he was smart enough to know that if you take two very tall, very beautifully built people, they produce children, and you select tall, beautifully built people and keep going, you can produce a virtual race of giants. Now, people just don't do that. Oftentimes, I've seen young people, very tall men marry very short, tiny women. I've seen the opposite of that. I remember one fellow I saw on the dance floor. Well, I better stop with that one. Anyhow, it says, where were the Mexican chihuahuas 2,000 years ago? Where were Guernsey cattle and Leghorn chickens? Where were the modern strains of tomatoes and corn and roses? This is a modern scientific biological textbook. It's asking very important questions. Where were the Guernseys? I'll be out in the field. And it says, their ancestors existed. So what's that prove? Beautiful, okay. But those ancestors bore little resemblance to poodles or chihuahuas only because they didn't cut their hair that way. That's all. There were lots of small dogs running around with big ears, but they hadn't, you know, gotten them down to this one little size that they call a chihuahua, teacup size, several types of chihuahuas. Obviously, it says, radical changes have occurred in a few thousand or even a few hundred years. Well, of course they have. That's no problem. Ancestors of the poodles and chihuahuas were wolves. Beautiful. What were the ancestors of wolves, though? Cows? No. See, here again, the Bible itself tells you about the almost infinite variety capable inside the human family. It talks at the beginning of Adam and Eve. It talks then with the gradual branching out, how God Almighty Himself must have put within the very body of Mother Eve the capacity for different colors and varieties of humankind. How some of these were lopped off at the flood of the Noachian deluge, of the Noachian time, and that the three children of Noah, his sons which were already married, that went aboard with him, represented these various basic color strains of the human family. Now you find degeneracies in different areas. And they say these are primitive people still existing side by side with advanced people. Well, I don't know about that. You may have seen or may not have seen Mondo Cane, but I didn't, but I heard a great deal about it. I wish I'd have seen it. Comes back, I will. But you take a look at some of these Stone Age societies they're forever discovering in some rainforest somewhere, and it's not that these people have been existing that way for thousands of years. It's just as easy to say that they gradually degenerated and drifted away from the centers of so-called civilization, which I wonder about, and knowledge. And that they are existing and coexisting side by side is as much a proof for some of the erroneous thinking about the discoveries of fossil life and the interpretation that one came from the other. The very fact that there exist people using so-called Stone Age tools in our modern Jet Age proves the contemporaneous nature of certain societies, and that if they had been buried by a great cataclysm, you may suppose that you would find some rather crude, primitive-looking people with crude, primitive-looking clothing and tools, and some fairly civilized, developed people with developed tools and clothing and art forms and so on, living contemporaneously. We find that today. Is that dishonest? No, but I don't know. You look into these evolutionary textbooks and you really begin to wonder. There's a kind of a spirit that pervades it, all right, and it's an anti-supernaturalistic bias that they will not look in to the fact that selective breeding and mutations do not prove that an alligator became a bird. It only proves infinite capacity for variety within a certain species, but not that one kind became another kind. As the human kind, and I don't care whether they look like a Neanderthal man wearing a bow tie in Macy's, or whether they look like somebody that came out of the jungles of Indonesia, and you find him walking around the streets, you think, man, that guy looks an awful lot like a mandrill, you know, or something like that. Well, that's his tough luck. He just happens to look that way. There are all kinds of heights and shapes and weights and colors and textures of skin and hair and eyes, and people walking around with lumbering gaits and quick little steps. You can look at any crowd of people and find practically anybody that would represent what people might say would look like some inferior subspecies of humanity. What about the pygmies in the Aituri forest?
But they're still human. That doesn't prove the one developed from the other. They're still human. Well, it's a vast subject. I've already covered it pretty thoroughly. And I want to tell you a few more things in a moment about the spirit of science and whether or not the spirit of science is the right spirit, whether it's something that is really all that exemplary and that could be applauded. They seem to be very, very proud of this thing of the spirit of science. To me, it's the wrong spirit.
A nation is only as strong as its family. If our nation were as strong as your family, how strong would it be? And if relationships in your family are not what you would like, where can you go for help? Plain Truth, a publication of understanding, is concerned. Every Plain Truth brings you helpful articles on how relationships can be strengthened between husband and wife, parents and children, families and neighbors. With interesting and useful information on helping your child enjoy learning at home and school, budgeting and sensible use of credit, preventing teenage depression, household health and safety, homemaking tips for the working mother, achieving full human potential, coping with inflation. Plain Truth emphasizes quality in all aspects of daily living. Let Plain Truth help strengthen your family and nation. Request your free subscription today. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
The spirit of science doesn't make too much sense when you stop to think that science, on the one hand, has given us the weapons by which we can destroy all of humankind. That science has given us, on the one hand, a glittering, glamorous world of unbelievable productivity, gross national product, technological intrusions into our life support systems all about us, and the resultant pollution that threatens our very existence, let alone the problems of the dirt and the filth we're forced to breathe and see all about us, the noise, pollution, everything else. People worship at the altar of science, and I, for the life of me, cannot see why. Science should hide its face in shame for being so guilty as to have achieved in such an enormously short period of time, from the time of the invention of the first aircraft, which was in my father's lifetime and a lot of yours, until today, we've come to the point where when kids used to, in living memory of human beings, run to the living room to see a so-called horseless carriage go by, we're sending men to the moon, and now we've come to the potential of annihilating all of humankind before we found out why we're here. I don't see why science deserves such accolades, such plaudits, such great credit for being so unbelievably intelligent as to usher mankind, perhaps willingly, along an avenue into a box canyon from which it appears there is no escape, and that what may loom on the horizon is the complete disintegration of society, the disruption and the total upheaval of all society, and perhaps the extermination of mankind. And science asks questions, it researches, it investigates, it discovers, it postulates. But when you say, why are we? They say, I don't know. What are we? They say, I don't know. Where are we going? They say, I don't know. What happens when we die? They say, I don't know, but I sure got some new ideas about how to kill ourselves. I don't know where science is worthy of so much tremendous credit. The spirit of science, as it was broken down in this excerpt from the pamphlet distributed by a governmental agency on education, said in point two, there is no perfect knowledge and no perfect knower. Certainty, as a concept, is replaced by probability. I am certain God exists. It's no probability in my mind. I know He exists because I've proved it. Not only have I proved it, I have experienced it. Now, that's something that anybody would look at me and laugh his head off and say, oh, sure, yeah, big deal. I'd like to talk to some medical man sometime and ask him how he can explain the phenomenon
of the absolute literal disappearance of a physical deformity in front of your eyes. I'd like to ask what people like that would have to say about something which I have absolutely seen before my own eyes. Well, that's another subject people can say. I went through a whole series of programs in which I proved God exists by all the methods and the tools of science. The law, lawgiver, life, life-giver, kind after kind, the sustainer, the designer, all these many, many phenomena of science itself. And the last one, of course, that of answered prayer, is one which no scientist is ever going to agree with, but he doesn't have to. Because no scientist, if he is an atheistic scientist, is going to agree with the idea of prayer. Of course, God isn't really all that hurt about it, because God doesn't need any help from scientists, and he's not asking them for anything one way or the other. It's up to them to believe what they would like, and it's up to God to do what he has determined he is going to do, and that which he is warning the world of in due time. But the point is, to all of this, those who are not really tainted to the degree that their minds are absolutely closed with this constant insistence that evolution is true, and who have not really looked into evolution, who are going along with a just-in-case religion, wondering about the articles written by science news writers in newspapers about bones being 600,000 years old. Then they go into a church, they hear a sermon about the creation of the world some thousands of years ago, which I don't believe in at all. I know the world could be billions of years of age. Why don't they forget about the present organization that is called the Judeo-Christian ethic, or the mainstream of Christianity, and look into the Bible for a change and see what it says? Because I say what the Bible says is completely different from what organized religion says it says. And when you see the antagonism between the ideas of evolution on the one hand and organized religion on the other, religion comes out second best every time. It's no wonder. In a couple of these textbooks, I had right here quotations about how science has proved that the world's got to be older than 6,000 years. Of course it has. That's the whole point. But the truth of the Bible hasn't suffered a bit. It's just that organized religion has suffered a little bit. So that's the point. Well, I don't have time to go through it all now, but I hope you'll keep your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine and write to the booklet on World Crisis in Agriculture. Many people believe science is going to come along and stave off starvation, the food and the population circle that are now in such a vicious, tormented, agonizing collision course. You will learn a little bit about the interrelationship in living organisms in the soil and your own digestive system. You'll learn why it is that humus is vital to soil, and why soil must be a living material and not just dirt, and how it is that soil can wear out. Soil can grow tired. Soil can become unproductive. This booklet, World Crisis in Agriculture, shows you all of that. You need to know whether or not we are just about to solve the agricultural crisis. This booklet on World Crisis in Agriculture shows you some facts you probably did not know before. Remember, only about 10% of the Earth's land surface is under cultivation. Remember that 6% of the population lives on about 6% of the land surface, and yet indulges itself in over 52% of the world's material goods. You want to read this booklet? It's a real eye-opener. It is gratis. It's free. It's an educational service in your own best interest. It asks you to join nothing. It requires you to spend nothing. All you need to do is to send your request to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, and we'll send it to you by return mail free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.